Again, my friend here, the Ali,
is an not only is the chairman, current chairman of the Parks and Business Council, but also an accomplished corporate leader. And not only that, but a thinking person, which we need quite a few these days. So, ladies and gentlemen, my presentation is set in the context, is to set the context and to highlight the issue that the Pakistan economy faces. And at IPR, we wanted to explore why Pakistan's economy is perpetually in crisis. And we have been trying to look at ways and means, what it would take to not just break out of this loop, but to get onto a path of sustained growth. And I'll be telling you how we have gone about studying these aspects. And while we see that in this region, Pakistan's economy has floundered, I mean, we have these spectacular examples of East Asia, and among them of China, which in a matter of two decades, 700 people came out of poverty in China, 700 million people. And that's a huge accomplishment. And we will talk a bit about some other East Asian economies too. But let me just say that as we began the study and before long, we saw that every example we looked at, the GDP growth was the key. And we discovered that whether it is increase in jobs or reduction in poverty or investment in people or infrastructure, we need to focus, and countries focused on GDP growth. And we also discovered that a country's national security and sovereignty, in essence, is dependent on its economic security and sovereignty. And that is why, I mean, Muid knows quite a bit about economy too, but we'd like to hear from Muid that for long-term national security and sovereignty, a strong economy is essential for any state. Now, it is easy to point fingers in our country as to why we have not grown and the share that goes to security expenses. And that may be partly true. But in doing so, we may be treating a deeper malaise by looking only at the surface. It seems that the neglect of education, healthcare, and the social deficit is so embedded in our thinking that to blame it all on national security would be a mistake. But before we got to such findings, we looked more deeply into some areas, and the first was a deep dive into recent trends in Pakistan's economy. We looked very carefully at the East Asian experience and, of course, on the ample literature on growth and development that exists in this world. And post-World War and later, East Asia did not wait for perfect conditions to occur. Their first focus was to, in every case, their first focus was to upgrade industrial structure in order to produce goods for exports. We also noticed in East Asia that each economy tailored policies for their needs and circumstances. So while the Pakistan economy has seen periods of moderate growth, data for the last two decades shows that in reality output of goods has been in decline in our country. It merits very definite attention. Decline in production of goods could affect exports also, and has affected exports. Growth has come mostly from services in the last two decades, but not exportable services, and primarily growth in the size of government was responsible for the growth in services. Many of our decision makers have taken credit for the short period of relative growth, but growth must last more than a couple of years, and our growth has lasted for not more than a few years. And overall, the trend has been one of decline in growth. A major World Bank study conducted about 10 years ago defined growth economies as those that have grown at an average annual rate of 7% or more for 25 years or more. And the study takes 7% as a benchmark because at that rate, an economy doubled in size every decade. Now, we have a slide right in front of us, and it shows the growth rates, GDP growth rates between 1952-53 and 2019. And what do we see here? We achieved GDP growth rate of 7% or more in just 12 out of 66 years. And the years of 7% growth were far apart. And they did not cause any meaningful momentum for GDP growth. And on just two occasions in over six decades, Pakistan has had two consecutive years of GDP growth rates of over 7%. As we move to the next slide, what do we see here? Since the 1960s, our average annual growth rate has declined. And unlike the 60s, when there was industrial boost, GDP growth in the later decades occurred when we received large amounts of external aid. And in the 1960s, the average annual growth rate was 6.8%. It fell to 4.8% in the 70s, 6.1% in the 80s, with a free flow of foreign aid. And in the next three decades, it remained at around 4.5% level. So we are in a decline here, very definitely. And as we move on to slide number three, as a percent of GDP, the contribution of agriculture and industry has declined and is declining, and that's a very serious thing. In growing economies, the contribution of agriculture usually declines. But that should result in an increase as a percent of GDP in manufacturing. But that too is declining, not as significantly as agriculture, but declining nonetheless. So where is the growth coming from? The growth really is coming from, as I mentioned earlier, from a large increase in services. And we would have been very happy about it if we were able to export a lot of these services, but as I said earlier, that we don't do. Let's so let me identify a few things which we have discovered through the literature and East Asian experience, we discovered that capital accumulation, which means more stock of capital, meaning new plants, machineries, physical assets, meaning improved human capital. And we need human capital so that the economies may adapt and adopt new technology. Structural transformation, which means that the economy should produce higher value goods and services that may be exported. These are the factors that basically growth comes from. Now, if we move on and if we move to slides 6, which is growth in total import versus import machinery. Now, let's see what's happening there. Between the years 2003 to 19, Pakistan's imports grew by 330%. Yet machinery imports grew by much less, 126%. If you move on to slide 7 and 8, the rates of savings and investment fell in Pakistan. And the large-scale manufacturing index was weak. And alarmingly, of course, when manufacturing is coming down as a percentage, the ratio of exports to GDP fell from 17%, and this is slide 9, 17% of GDP in the 1990s to 8% at present. So obviously, when there is a decline as a percentage of GDP in manufacturing, it will definitely mean a decline as a percentage of GDP in exports. And it clearly means that the economy neither increased capacity nor it built competitiveness, as is shown in the slide that you're saying. One reason that exports go down is you're not manufacturing, producing enough. The output is not enough. The other is that whatever you're producing is not competitive enough. The world is moving on. As you've seen, that there was a time when exports were more sensitive to your exchange rate, but now even that is not happening, and the reason is that you are not producing and at the cost that the world is ready to buy and what your competitors are producing. So let's have a look on the human capital side. Slide 10, next slide. Pakistan is behind many countries, and it's behind many countries with similar GDP per capita. It's not just the rich countries that the Pakistan is behind. It's behind countries, as you can see in this very busy graph. But what it is telling you is that with countries having more or less the same GDP per capita, Pakistan is way below. And the next slide is telling you, slide 12, slide 11, that the productivity is low and there's virtually no product innovation in Pakistan. And what we see in the next slide, slide number 12, is as a result, Pakistan manufacturing did not grow, and Pakistan's shares of manufacturing in GDP is well below that of other countries, as is indicated in the slide that you're saying. We're probably at the bottom. The only consolation we can take is that we are not too far behind India, but let me just say that the spectacular growth rates that India has seen have been followed by a even more spectacular falls, because I personally believe that even in India, the what we are talking about here today, the structural transformation did not take place, and therefore they could not or have not been able to sustain their growth. Okay, so what we also discovered that government policies and practices help growth of industry, and every country in East Asia that has grown has had a very deep interest of their leadership and of their government with a single objective of achieving growth and improving the lives of their citizens. Of course, we need political and macro stability, and we need well-governed institutions, we need rule of law, and firms and citizens need public goods, infrastructure, education, skills, health, sanitation. They all help productivity. In addition, of course, a legal framework that ensures efficient markets and a respect for private property and contract enforcement. It seems that Pakistan policymakers have not prioritized creation of these preconditions. If you go to slide 15, the economy has never had macro stability. We have had current, and we got to move on, Ashraf Sahab. Yeah. Now, what does this chart show? We have had current and fiscal account deficits even while receiving large amounts of aid. It's a economic fact that the fiscal and the current deficits are linked, and one leads to the other. And our country revenue has not kept pace with expenses. And still there has been no effort to limit spending. And as a result, there's no money left to fund public goods and fiscal deficit. We are even borrowing to make ends meet, even borrowing for current expenditure. If we move on to slide 16, what do we see here? We have used foreign aid, foreign debt, to even meet day-to-day expenses. Since 2000, it's an alarming fact, only 38% of total aid is for projects. The rest is mostly in support of the budget and balance of payments. Obviously, we also know that government has to do a lot of domestic borrowing, which crowds out private sector. And the foreign debt has kept the economy in crisis. Now, as we move to the next slide, what do we see? As of right now, I mean, it's not shown in this, in the last bar, but I think as we move into fiscal 20, debt servicing is close to half the budget right now. And of course, to be able to keep up with it, we borrow even more. And it's a very interesting slide, and it's the last slide, give you some relief. But I find it very, the one after this, Ashraf Sahab. Yeah. Now, this is a very interesting table. And what it what we see here is that the GDP the debt and liability has increased at almost twice the rate of the GDP growth. Now that's an alarming situation. And the debt and liabilities have increased many times more than your exports. And perhaps that tells you why we have been to the IMF for 23 times. Okay, so enough of the slides. I mean, obviously there's a mutually dependent relationship between macroeconomic stability and growth, and weak macro indicators prevent growth, and low growth prevents improvement in these indicators. Well, we very definitely know that macro stability cannot be treated through short-term measures of cut-and-paste solutions. It needs a well-considered program aligned with domestic situation and one that balances growth with stability. So, our fragile macro indicators, just to summarize some of the things we've discussed, they result from a revenue system that is unable to meet the government's financing needs, and a government unable to cut its coat according to the cloth. A consumption-led growth that relies on external inflows, remittances, and aid. And it also relies, there's one other factor for this consumption-led growth. We are in this deadly habit of keeping our currency overvalued. And what does that mean as we move on? It means more expensive exports. It means cheaper imports. And when imports are cheap, of course, it feeds to the consumption-led growth. And it does one other thing. It weakens the tariff protection that is being provided to your local industry. And that is how why the industry also starts going down. So I will have a number of suggestions, but the foremost will be the external debt to meet operational expenditures must stop at least. And from now on, we must prefer investment based on external debt that generates exports. I am a huge supporter of CPAC. I am a huge supporter of CPAC. And I know that if you can call it CPAC phase one, it was essential. There was a huge power shortage, infrastructure shortage. And I'm very happy to see that both the governments and the private sectors are right now focusing in the next phase of CPAC, which will focus on joint ventures, and it will focus on private sector joint ventures and more investment going into areas which will generate export earnings for Pakistan. And let me also say that Pakistan's economy does not save enough to increase investment without resorting to foreign savings. Nor does it manufacture enough goods to export and earn foreign exchange. So, in its present framework, the economy can avoid an external crisis only if it functions at a low equilibrium with modest level of savings, investments, imports, and exports. I'll give you two examples. In the first decade, we grew very rapidly. But in 2008, we were back with the IMF. Look at the last government. I mean, we were beginning to grow, but as soon as they were gone, we were back with the IMF. So the economy current structure is the moment you try to grow, you end up in a balance of payment crisis. And that's because we do not have the factors in place to generate growth on a sustained basis. So what's our problem? Unlike the growth economies, Pakistan does not have an industrial policy that incentivizes efficient industries. Pakistan's public spending is meager, and what it spends is not properly used. We lack the drivers of growth. And what are the drivers of growth? An accumulation of physical capital to support business activity, human capital, technological progress, improving our savings and investment rate. And it's a World Bank study which says that it is extremely important that the investment increases from 15% to 25% of GDP, and that is the only thing that will unlock Pakistan's growth potential. My conclusions, of course, we have mentioned, we've talked, everybody says so, but we have observed in our study that growth economies ensure political stability. They ensure social cohesion and law and order and macro stability. And they ensure secure borders, not only for their security, but to allow trade with the region. And we need to invest in people and infrastructure to boost competitiveness. So we need an industrial policy that supports efficient manufacturing. Economies adapt foreign technology and increase their domestic production. Once firms reach a critical mass, these goods are exported. We need to create an escalating cycle of higher value addition. Competitiveness of the economy is key, as exports is the primary goal. The success of growth economies confirm that growth comes from following a set of policies. Once decided, these policies must be followed without compromise. East Asia demonstrates that development is a political choice, not an algorithm. Committed leaders and an effective team led the change in East Asia. Pakistan must not just change its economic policies, it must change the whole governance paradigm. We must make the political choice of providing public goods, infrastructure that firms need, better health, education, enhance human capital. And for macro stability, I recommend three measures. Stop incurring foreign debt for budget support and for balance of payments. Such debt should be for the most vital projects. And I know some of my friends won't like it, but we must review all imports, and some will actually. We must review all imports, and where possible, replace them with domestic substitutes. We must use forex primarily to import key inputs and technology for manufacturing. And we must end or tax short-term foreign portfolio investments. Such inflows are not a solution, they are a problem. And we must stop celebrating them. They go out as fast as they come in. Another task is to reduce and gradually end budget deficits. Growth economies offer subsidies to state-owned enterprises to induct new technology, a new product or a new service. But unfortunately, at taxpayers' expense, we give subsidy as a reward for their poor performance. And my submission to the government is that whether you wish to reform or restructure or privatize SOEs, we must act early to reduce the burden on the budget. We must make every effort to increase savings, and I think the focus of the government on e-savings platforms is important, because that's a major platform right now. We should focus on infrastructure funds. And the DFIs that existed in the 60s through the 90s played a very significant role in the industrial development of Pakistan, but they remain no more. And I think that we must create a DFI or two, including an Exim Bank. We must become part of the global supply chain. It's much easier said than done. And for that, we need to improve our relations in the region, upgrade our logistics, quicken our ports, customs clearance, and most importantly, have compatible tax and duty regimes to become part of the global supply chain. One recommendation I wish to make for all this to work, let's create a manufacturing, investment, and export promotion organization that should plan, implement, monitor execution of the industrial policy. And the Prime Minister must lead this organization, and this organization must work with the private sector to select industry, decide incentives, and monitor progress. Sustained growth is possible only through export of high-value goods, and we recommend that the government should set up a commission on science and technology on the lines of the Pakistan Atomic Energy Commission. The commission will help firms acquire the knowledge to manufacture and export value-added goods. It will also lead with training, R&D, and enforcing standards so that Pakistan earns a reputation as a producer of quality. And while I say all this, governments only play a guiding role for the economy. It does not mean weakening the role of markets. Market is a key force in any economy, and East Asia shows that growth policy supplements the role of markets without diminishing it. And my last submission, the challenge before us today is not just to correct the deep shortcomings of past decades, it is also to create a new covenant between the people and the state by reinventing the paradigm for making decisions in the country. Thank you.